Hello, everyone. This is Eric Filion from the Department of History at Queen's University. This is the fifth and final episode prepared for Curating for Change, the work that music festivals do in the world, a two-part online conference hosted by the University of Guelph and Queen's University. We held the first part at the end of August and just concluded part two on October 14th and 15th. Our primary objective with this conference was to bring together a diverse set of perspectives to extend our understanding of the work that independent, artist-run, or boutique music festivals do in promoting vital forms of activist arts-based practices, pedagogies, and community making. Today's episode is a keynote conversation between Simon Frith and Joe Haynes. It was recorded during part two of our conference on Friday, October 14th. Simon Frith is Emeritus Professor at the University of Edinburgh. He held, from 2006 to 2017, the Tovey Chair of Music. For much of his career, as both an academic and a journalist, he was engaged with the problems of taking popular music seriously. He was a founding member of the International Association for the Study of Popular Music and a founding editor of the journal Popular Music. As a journalist, he started out as an editor of the pioneering British rock magazine Let It Rock and became rock critic for both the Sunday Times and The Observer, as well as a music columnist for the New York Village Voice. He chaired the judges of the Mercury Music Prize from 1992 until 2016, was elected a fellow of the British Academy in 2011, and was appointed officer of the Order of the British Empire in the 2017 New Year Honours for services to higher education and popular music. Joe Haynes is associate professor in sociology at the University of Bristol. Her research focuses on the sociology of popular music, music festivals, ethnicity and race, diversities, cultural work, and digital entrepreneurship. She has recently co-edited a volume called Remaking Culture and Music Spaces, Affects, Infrastructures, Futures, which is the culmination of research from a funded project on European music festivals, public spaces, and cultural diversity. Check out festiversities.com. She has also published a research monograph called Music, Difference, and the Residue of Race, and has published in leading journals, including British Journal of Sociology and New Media and Society. Let's listen.
Simon's work has been very significant in the sociology of popular music, shaping a number of debates and key issues, and indeed shaping the study of popular music itself over the last few decades. More recently, he has done some work around live music, but today we're focusing very specifically on music festivals and the work they do in the world. So I thought it's probably best to start with the elephant in the room, which is the pandemic, and ask Simon what impact he thinks the pandemic has had on music festivals.
Thank you. It's not a very easy question to answer in simple terms, but I think I would say we have to distinguish a bit between the different sorts of people involved in festivals. So the biggest effect, I think, was musicians, and particularly something that's often not talked about, the technicians and the technical people on whom musicians depend. So all those people who enable musicians to perform to the site, to festivals, outdoors with particular sound problems, et cetera, lighting. There's a huge number of essentially freelance professionals who suddenly lost all their work, not only in festivals or anything else they might have done, the public performance. And I think they were the ones who suffered most. And certainly in the experience of my own people I know, or friends or children of friends, many of those people decided that it was a precarious enough profession anyway, and it was time they chose to think about doing something else. So I think for them, there's been a major shift, and I think the actual employment base for those technicians and professionals has shifted. And although people are obviously now able to get work, I think there are a number of people who are no longer quite sure that this work, and particularly the amount of traveling involved, is the sort of work they want. Secondly, and obviously musicians, they also lost live performance work. but they were able to, at least in some sense, sustain some sort of public presence by by digital performance, by streaming from their bedrooms, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's a huge money loss. But I think on the whole, musicians, their lives are about music making, and they went on making music and they'll continue to make music. And, you know, the return of festivals has been a great boost to them being able to recontact with their audiences. Thirdly, there's been the festival business. And one of the things I think we need to come on to is that festivals is a very big business. It's very corporate in many ways. It depends very much on a number of commercial interests, not just promoters, but all the people who sell things at festivals, the promoters and so on. And all those people, again, had sort of no income for 2 years. And I think what we're going to see here is that the biggest players can always survive these sort of crises, and the big festivals will continue much as they were. I think there will be a lot of churn in small festivals. I don't think there'll be less festivals, but I think there might be new sorts of festivals promoted by new sorts of people. And then finally, there's audiences, which I think is the most complicated, and which I think Joe probably has done much more work than I have on thinking about this. My sense is that people desperately, as humans, need to take part in live music events. I'm talking as somebody who, from the age of about 20 to the age of 70, went to 2 or 3 live gigs every week. And, you know, this was part of my life. And it was a very, very strange feeling not to be going to live music. And one of the effects it had on me is I also didn't listen to it. It didn't mean I listened to more music at home. I just had less music in my life altogether. And I think people desperately want to go back to going to concerts and festivals. But again, I suspect there's differences which may be generational, that certainly people, older people, are less sure they want to go to huge festivals full of people who may be infectious or whatever, but just that very crowded sense of lack of space around you. Whereas I think young people who've never really had that experience are just desperate to get to Glastonbury because they've never been there and so on. So I think though, again, over time, I don't think we know enough yet. I think there'll be I think we will see changes in what people demand from and expect of festivals. And in some ways, I'm optimistic that this will be good for the sort of festivals that this conference is interested in, and that some of the sort of minor commercial festivals might fade away, but they'll be replaced by something more interesting.
Right. It's interesting in several ways what you've just said, Simon, because one of the things that we found when we were doing our research, because it obviously got reoriented, we had to reorient it because of COVID. We couldn't do the festival research we wanted to do. And that meant that we did emphasize more of the production and organization of the music festivals. So it struck me that what you said about the technicians, the tech crews and so on, the people that are typically not really talked about when it comes to music production, they became far more visible to us as we were doing our research. And we spent a lot of time talking to them and the impact of the lack of festivals on their lives, but also just talking in general about the significance of working live, how it framed the work that they did. So they were very, very revealing. And one thing I did note, this is true of the UK context, I don't know if you agree, Simon, but that festivals, despite their cancellation, they did actually become more visible in certain ways because they got to assert themselves more within national debates about the fact that the government support wasn't very forthcoming initially. And, you know, there was some kind of failure at the government level to really understand the sort of business models of festivals and how they operate and the kind of the festival cycle. So I guess, could we say that's a kind of one possibly positive aspect of the impact of the crisis on festivals, that there was this sense of visibility around them?
I think there was a sense of visibility around. I think it would have been better if we'd had a different government. I'm not sure that very much was acted on the visibility. I mean, if you look at the funding that was eventually made available to musicians, assuming they've got a high enough income to benefit from it, on the whole, that sort of income was not available to technicians. So, I mean, and so obviously that became a political discussion, which was a good thing. But I think what we did, it's interesting that the original festival, maybe if you go back to the 60s and 70s when the free festival movement eventually led to commercial festivals, that very much came out of the government responding to certain crises and regulating them in new sorts of ways. And I don't think we've had a government for a long time that is actually very interested in the notion of promoting festivals, or not so much promoting them, but enabling people to put on festivals in the way they want. And we can come back to this, but You have to remember that certainly in Britain, festivals are very highly regulated, for obvious reasons, gathering a lot of people in the public space and making a lot of noise affects all sorts of people who also live there. So it's not just a simple thing we can all celebrate. There are people who would rather that there wasn't that noise when they're going to sleep at night. And I think one of the classic cases of this is festivals that happen in public parks in London, where the festival organisers effectively will close off a public park for 3 days. And all the local inhabitants are used to going, walking their dogs there or sunbathing. And it's a nice warm summer weekend, are suddenly deprived of one of the few spaces they've got in their neighbourhood. So the festival can't simply be seen as a good thing. It's got to be understood in terms of a surrounding community. And I think the politics of festivals that really matters is going to be local politics rather than national politics in that context.
Yeah, absolutely. It just sort of, it's a complete contrast to what the festival is meant to be doing in that sense, because of the fact that if you do decide to sort of close off an area in the centre of a city like London or anywhere, in fact, you're actually closing it off to people that have another purpose and use for that particular space. What you mentioned audiences as well in relation to the impact of the pandemic. And it was interesting to see, and possibly this happened elsewhere as well in Canada, where young people and others decided to take matters into their own hands and create their own kind of festival. Obviously, this was during, you know, at times when there were meant to be, you know, restrictions in place. So this kind of urge and desire to meet together around music was very, very, very strong throughout the pandemic. And, you couldn't sort of contain it, as it were.
Yeah, I think in Britain that happened in context of dance culture and raves. Suddenly, the illegal raves suddenly made a reappearance for the first time for 15 years.
Yeah. Okay, so in your blog that you wrote during pandemic, I think it was about June 2020, so quite early on in the pandemic, Home Thoughts on Festive Occasions, you said that festivals might like to rethink their return to business as usual, and that they might try different kinds of models and different kinds of practices. What kinds of changes were you envisaging at that point?
The changes, just to put it very crudely, I think could be summed up in the idea that they should be smaller. The big festival is very un-green. And in terms of sustainability, it's a very odd thing for us to celebrate. It has people travelling great distances. It has musicians particularly travelling great distances, obviously, by aeroplanes. It creates a huge amount, and it depends on a huge amount of electricity being generated. It generates huge amounts of rubbish, which may be more or less efficiently got rid of. I mean, a big festival like Glastonbury does its best to be green in its own context, but it's nevertheless, it is not future-friendly, I would say. And I think we've got to think better about how people are going to have to think more locally, in more small terms, not think that a festival has to have global superstars to be a major festival. But a festival can celebrate music in ways that are not necessarily tied in with a commercial star system. And there are lots of models of those sort of festivals. I just think it's part of the common sense of festivals. When people say music festival, they think Glastonbury. And they need to start thinking some other sorts of festivals and how long those big festivals will survive. But it's difficult to think that the huge, you know, the cream fields in the dance world or the Glastonbury's and the Reading Leeds or the big festivals they're having all over Europe are really sustainable once we start taking global warming seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you there. And you see, or you saw during the pandemic, how some festivals, I guess, because of the consequence of the pandemic and the flight restrictions, how international travel was very difficult, by default, they became more localized festivals. And it wasn't about the big acts, the big international acts that were touring, that doing their summer tour, et cetera. It became more about the local artists, or certainly domestic artists became more important at that point. I mean, some festivals obviously do have that as their objective. They don't necessarily go for the bigger names, can't afford the bigger names. But by default, I think a lot more festivals were doing that. So it will be interesting to see whether that continues for other reasons as well, as you say, in relation to, you know, it's the unsustainability of having this sort of mobility of all these people coming to a certain space in a town in say in the UK, and all the kind of waste and problems that generates in itself, and problems for the environment. I mean, do you think that that there's greater expectations today on festivals to be more, regardless of the festival, whether its emphasis is on music or on the kind of lifestyle or the politics, that there's more expectation to be more inclusive, more diverse, more sustainable in climate change terms and responsible in various ways?
Yes, because I think there are political pressures on festivals as there are on everybody else. And this is a reflecting changes that are going on in society, that when society is beginning to think about how, you know, the dominance of every institution by men, and the Glastonbury Festival, people look at the statistics and 95% of the people on the stages are men, then obviously they're going to have to respond to that sort of pressure. So I think we're going to see that, and, you know, there are other sorts of pressures that they're responding to. I think the sustainability pressure is there, and not altogether, and, you know, all these festivals will put out how they're going to be carbon neutral or whatever. I think what one, I read those with a degree of cynicism. It seems to me what they're about is sustaining their profits rather than sustaining the globe, doing what's the minimal to try and make people think they're okay. So I think, you know, cynicism about some of the changes, but others are just necessary. They're reflecting what the world's about. I don't think you could have the same lineup at a Glastonbury Festival across all stages and the same sort of assumptions about who musicians are and what sort of music they make than what you could have had, say, 25 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's, I think in the last, during the pandemic, one of the interesting things we found that was just as much as the pandemic was a pressure on festivals, when we were talking to the organisers and the producers of festivals during that time, which where our emphasis shifted to, there was also, especially in the context of Bristol and the resurgence of the Black Lives Matters movement and the toppling of a statue in the centre of the city, that was also a big pressure on the way in which festival organisers framed their events. So it wasn't just, you know, the pandemic, it became a kind of another issue. Well, it was an issue for them, but it was very much on their minds and framing the way that they talked about their festival and how they were going to try and reshape it for the future. But certainly in terms of ethnic and racial diversity, I know that a lot of music festival organisers, they find it very sort of difficult to get diverse audiences into their festivals, despite, you know, trying a number of tactics to facilitate that. I'm wondering if you've sort of come across that.
Yes, definitely, but it's not just festivals, it's also venues for the same reason.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're kind of approaching it the wrong sort of way. They're making the assumption that people want to go to a festival because someone the same colour as they are is playing on the stage. But it may be much more that it doesn't feel like their sort of place. And it's a bit like going to a university which has been historically white and still very white in lots of the ways it operates, and coming as a, you know, first or second generation ethnic minority person. You can do perfectly well in classes and things, but still have a sense that this is not your place, you know, that you've been allowed in because you've been clever, but you're not really being accepted as who you are. And I think that's something, I mean, Glastonbury, you know, it retains its image very much of a white rock festival. And even if Stormzy's, it doesn't mean he's not popular with white rock fans. Precisely successful because he's popular across a whole range of people. What's interesting, and it would be why there aren't, or what's happened to sort of what you might call black music festivals. And I think, you know, the Milas, or the, you know, the Asian music festivals, which also got a long history, they tend to be much more rooted in the community, in local music makers, as well as big stars coming in. And in the sense of a culture that's being expressed. And I'm not sure that a black music festival in sort of popular music terms is much more on display in carnivals, whether in Bristol, whether in London, than it is in a rock festival. So I'm not sure that, you know, trying to get diverse audiences in, it may be that that's not what the festival is. You've got to kind of change the model altogether.
Yeah, one of the conclusions we sort of drew was that there was a problem with the way in which the whole inception of the festival in the first place. So, for example, you know, you get with festival organization, with, you know, the organization of live music more broadly, I guess, is that there's kind of a network of friendships involved in music with the same kind of music taste, for example, and they get their friends to get involved, and, you know, they know a producer here and a you know, lighting person there, and they come together, and that in itself might close off other kinds of networks of friends that might not necessarily reflect their own kind of ethnic or class background. So we thought this was a kind of problematic aspect of the way in which festivals arose over time. Then you know, they turn around and wonder why, you know, their organizations are all white or all male or all middle class or whatever it is. You know, and I think there's a need for more sort of reflexivity when it comes to the kind of organization itself.
I think one thing to look at, which is interesting here, is jazz festivals. If you look at, say, the development of the London Jazz Festival, it did respond to the fact that in London particularly, there's a huge young black jazz audience and musicians who overlap with white jazz musicians and who have their and play in different venues, not just playing Ronnie Scott's, but playing in other sorts of venues. And the London Jazz Festival has a different model where they will have shows going on in all different sorts of venues, so that those sorts of venues become as important to the festival as, you know, the Queen's Hall, it might be, or Queen Elizabeth Hall. So in fact, you're thinking a bit about where people normally go to see music, who they go with, how those friendships work. I mean, it goes back to this thing about festivals become sort of delocalized. And so they remove themselves from a community by planting themselves in the field, almost for accidental reasons, because it's available. Whereas festivals that develop within communities are more likely to reflect the change in the community.
Absolutely, yes. We were involved with the Bristol Jazz and Blues Festival. And because the building that they normally use as their venue, which used to be called the Colston Hall, and because of the sort of ongoing debates in Bristol, the name was changed because, of course, that was named after the former slave trader, Edward Colston. So now it's called Bristol Beacon. And they couldn't have their festival there because it's undergoing refurbishment, and they found themselves, you know, using lots of different venues in the city. And in fact, slowly but surely, they're beginning to realise that, well, this venue here, you know, closer to more of the sort of African Caribbean community in St. Paul's, we're seeing more diversity. So I think it's suddenly sort of dawning on them, well, the problem with the Colston Hall to begin with, you know, perhaps they could have seen that coming, but, you know, to diversify by just spreading themselves out around the city a bit more and going to places that younger people go to, more diverse ethnically people go to, etc. So, yes, that happened in Bristol as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think as we're drawing to an end, one of the things that always interests me is why festivals became so important for people writing about music. You know, the festival, I can see one of the things we're interested in our history is how the festival came to dominate the live music economy, which is quite an odd thing and developed. And it's not just in, we've been talking very much about popular music festivals, but we haven't been talking about classical music, but exactly the same thing is true there. The festival was very important because of its way of drawing audiences together over a period of time. So you can get more different musicians on it, gives you more possibilities of what live music can be. But I think a lot of the focus on festivals by academics has sort of taken away from other things that are happening, which don't get counted as festivals, but you might call community events or educational. The way in which, you know, in a place like Bristol, which I think is an important example of this, there are all sorts of activities that are kind of public activities that bring people together in certain sorts of ways, and which have been very important for developing, you know, crossover musics, for which Bristol has been a great pioneer in British popular music history. And they weren't really to do with festivals in the way in which people talk about festivals. We need to think more about these sort of, how do people come together to make music, in what circumstances, what are the problems, how does it make it easier for women to get involved in those processes, how are they excluded? And these things are not just to do with festivals, they're a much broader sense of, you know, of how we use music as a kind of community builder or a community as an expression of people's desires and demands.
Sure. So looking at the other kinds of spaces that that light's not necessarily shone upon within the dominant kind of debates within music sociology, for example. So the festival has taken on a very sort of big importance, I guess, for the reasons that you said. Also, and you know, for the business reasons, of course, it's easy, isn't it? Efficient way of organizing music, but there's also the kind of cultural experience of music in those kinds of spaces, which clearly, you know, resonates with huge audiences. So we've still got a couple of minutes, I think, maybe if we round off the discussion with a question about festivals and the balance between, where the balance lies between freedom and fun aspect of festivals and festivals as spaces for serious contemplation of social issues.
I think festivals on the model at the moment are places for fun. And, you know, it's difficult to see. I mean, you know, the famous example of Glastonbury, where everybody's chanted Jeremy Corbyn and he got, you know, big applause and everything, and then got the worst results for the Labour Party for many years, you know, shortly mm-hmm. afterwards. So there's a sort of disjuncture between what was actually fun chanting, you know, we love Jeremy Corbyn or whatever it was, and what political thinking would be about. And I don't think I would go to a festival for political enlightenment. I mean, there are festivals. I mean, when I was many years ago, I used to go to what the Communist Party organised in Italy called the Festa dell'Unità. And you'd gather in this huge place and there'd be lots and lots of food being sold and bookshops with pamphlets and then people making speeches, which were in Italian, so I didn't understand them, from the stage, and a lot of music. And the atmosphere was absolutely wonderful. And that was being organised by a political party, which in those days had a strong sense of their local working class community. Mm-hmm. So for most of the people there who were local Italians, it was like a holiday. And it was a bit like another example would be the miners' jubilee in Durham, where you'd have brass bands playing and people eating their picnics and listening to speeches. And it would be a celebration of who they were with music. And it was sort of part of the sort of expressing your solidarity. So those sort of political communities you can see, but a festival which, in a sense, changed things or changed people's minds or thinking about new things, I don't think that I haven't seen the festival model, which that is more important than having fun.
Yeah, I agree. I've seen festivals create their kind of their pillars of, you know, their ethical pillars, their, you know, pillars of responsibility, etc. And yet they, I don't want to mention names here in this, but, you know, they're the exact opposite, you know, they're the worst offenders in terms of, you know, young people leaving their tents, you know, strewn all over the fields with rubbish here. So it doesn't kind of marry up with, yeah, some of the kind of desire for that kind of freedom and fun and letting go for that kind of space, that weekend or whatever it is. So yeah, absolutely, I agree with that. And interestingly, I've been to a similar festival that you mentioned in relation to Italy in Paris, actually, on the outskirts of Paris, the kind of Communist Party putting on a big kind of event. And it was about music, it was about speeches. I couldn't understand the speeches, it was in French. But it was also a lot of food and partying as well alongside that. So you just reminded me of that.
Okay. Thank you for the good questions, Jo.
Yeah, thank you, Simon.
That was Simon Fritt and Jo Haynes in a keynote conversation, opening part two of Creating for Change, the work that music festivals do in the world. What is the work that music festivals do in the world? Can music festivals spark changes in behaviors or institutions? What about policies or even ways of being? For answers to these questions and to find out more, visit whatmusicfestivalsdo.ca.